Welcome, everyone. Got a small crowd today. Relatively small agenda. This may be our last small agenda today. We will start by opening a work session on Senate Bill 850. And this bill, we adopted a Dash 3 amendment last week, and we finally realized that it does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So, Senator Starr, if you're comfortable with our progress so far, we could use a motion to refer this to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 850 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 850 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Objections? So ordered. And again, Senator Beyer, I thank you for saving us on that one. Heavens knows what would have happened if it had gotten to the floor. Okay. We will now open a work session on Senate Bill 198. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 198 comes to you at the request of Attorney General Hardy Myers, Attorney General of Sexual Assault Task Force. You have the Dash 3 amendments in front of you. Allows the alleged victim of a personal crime to select a personal representative to accompany alleged victim to virtually all phases of the investigation and prosecution, prohibits court and law enforcement from preventing the personal representative from accompanying the victim. You have the Dash 3 amendments before you, and I think it may help to have a couple of people come up. I think Lynnell Schenkel and Kelly Skye, because they'd like to make a comment about the Dash 3 amendments. They were telling me something, I think, as it relates to page 2 of the amendments. The fact that a victim has or has not selected a personal representative section may not be used as evidence in the criminal case, and I think they'd like to make a further statement on that. Okay. They're asking me to put on the record, but I didn't quite get what they were saying.
Okay, why don't we ask those two, Kelly Skye and Renee Schenkel, to come up. And I'm having trouble finding my Dash 3 amendments. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. For the record, Ron Alshenko with the Department of Justice. Here today, just to clarify, the amendments 198-3 were negotiated between the Department of Justice, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and the Oregon Law Center. We just wanted to go on the record to clarify that not only do these amendments take care of concerns discussed previously with the committee, but more importantly, they do nothing to change the existing protocol and process in criminal cases. The fact that we will have available in Oregon law something or someone using the term personal representative does not create a new legal right or a new term. That still may be my friend, my mother, my relative, and all of the opportunity to call those people as witnesses and discuss the particulars of a case will remain in effect. And we just wanted to clarify there is no intent to change that part of the law.
Thank you. Did you have anything to add?
Certainly. Kelly Skye, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And just to make clear that subsection 7, which says that whether or not the victim has selected a personal representative, may not be used as evidence in the criminal case. What we were trying to avoid is that language prohibit a defense attorney from bringing out the fact that that person, the mother, the friend, whoever it is that is chosen as the personal representative, if that person is not allowed to attend a particular proceeding due to the law enforcement agency or the healthcare provider's objection. We can still bring that out as evidence in the criminal case. What we can't do is say you had a right to a personal representative. The term personal representative is what we're trying to avoid being used in a criminal case. But the fact that the person themselves was prohibited from being involved is still admissible in the criminal case.
Okay. And just for my education, how would that be valuable?
Chair Burdick, the immediate scene that comes to my mind is frequently we have a victim who later says that they said something different to the police than what the police are saying that they said. And in those cases, it may be that the victim, and if it correlates with the defense, that the defense is going to be claiming that law enforcement overly aggressively interrogated the victim or is misrepresenting what the victim told them. And the fact that they were not allowed to have their mother or their friend who was with them be present for the questioning may be, that could be used as evidence, you know, argued as evidence that law enforcement didn't want that person there so that there wouldn't be a witness to the actual conversation.
I see. Okay. Thank you. Any questions from the committee on this?
Mr. Burdick, if I might add for the record, the representative from the Oregon District Attorney's Association was unable to be here, but I do have an email from Gina Skinner with the Washington County Program. She did get a chance to see the dash threes this morning, and they are in support.
Okay, so the dash threes are acceptable, and the bill itself came from the Sexual Assault Task Force.
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you. With no opposition, as I recall. Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you. Senator Starr, have you had a chance to form an opinion on the dash three amendments?
Yes, Madam Chair. Good piece of work. I move the dash three amendment to Senate Bill 198.
Senator Starr has moved the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 198. Is there discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 198 is amended to the floor with the new pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 198 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Walker, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
Senator Walker is signed up for Senate Bill 198. Okay, now for the hot item of this session today, we will open a work session on Senate Bill 920. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 920 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission, and it substantially rewrites Oregon's law as it relates to execution sales. You have the dash two amendments in front of you, and they are extensive and basically relate to the part that relates to a redemption. We have Joel Watson here and Dave Hendricks, who can give you further information concerning the bill and the amendments.
Yes, if both of you would please come up, I appreciate it. As I recall, you got a little bit shortchanged on the initial hearing on this. And maybe I think we'll spend a little more time than we would normally spend in a work session. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Hendricks, did you want to start?
Members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Acting Legislative Counsel. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you may have on what is a very long and technical bill. I should explain that the Dash 2 amendments, which appear so extensive, primarily a rewrite of the procedures relating to redemption after a judicial sale. And I should back up a little bit here since not everybody was here when we first talked about this bill. This bill addresses the scenario in which a person has acquired a judgment against another person and has been forced to go to kind of what is the ultimate remedy, which is to seize property of that person and sell it to try to recover the monies that were owed underneath the judgment. And these are of interest, of course, for child support judgments, for criminal judgments, for all those sorts of orders that come up from state agencies with respect to how you enforce those orders, because those orders eventually become judgments. So it's a very significant piece of the puzzle when you're looking at both private parties trying to collect on their judgments as well as the state trying to collect on debts that are owed to the state. It's a complicated area because of the long history that's wrapped around this, and one of the most complicated aspects are the redemption rights. Redemption rights, the common one that we think of is the debtor themselves. If I'm a debtor, if I owe money to Jerry here, and Jerry sues me and gets a judgment, and Jerry says, pay up or else, and I don't, Jerry could go ahead and attempt to sell my house. Now, of course, he would sell it subject to the homestead exemption, but the homestead exemption is only a certain amount, so they could still go after value in excess of the homestead exemption that I own in the house. Let's assume that I don't come up with the money even then, and the sheriff goes ahead and sells that property. For a period of time after that sale, I may be able to come back and reacquire that property by paying whoever bought that property at the judgment sale whatever they paid. So that's redemption rights. That's one of the things I have. The mechanism for doing that and the different scenarios that come up with other people who may have similar rights because of the sale of the property is extremely complicated. If you tried to read this, you'd quickly find that out. When we finished up preparing the bill, 920, for introduction, this was an Oregon Law Commission project, so there was an extensive work group process that went along with this that Gary could fill you in with better than I. All I know is that hundreds of hours went into it. But even with all that work, when we got to introducing the bill, there was still considerable concern about how well we had covered the redemption area. And so the Dash 2 amendments were the result of efforts and work that was done after the bill was printed to try to resolve that and get it clear. And the work group has reviewed those and sent out to them by email to look at, and hopefully it gets a clearer statement on this. Just talking just a little bit about the rest of the bill in general, most of it is to bring it up to date. These were statutes that were written a long, long time ago, and we're definitely in need of some modernizing, if nothing else, to bring them into agreement with what the sheriffs actually did when they went to sell property. For instance, Section 7 of the bill has a long section about instructions to the sheriff about how to go about doing these sales. There was nothing like that in the prior law, even though that is the way it really worked. The sheriff depended entirely upon instructions from the judgment creditor as far as what it was they were supposed to do, which property they were supposed to go after, what they were supposed to do with the property, but you wouldn't find any of that in the statute. It's now all spelled out in the bill, and we have two sheriffs who were working on the work group and giving us instructions that were very helpful, because they're the ones who are the true experts in this area. Not so much the attorneys usually, the sheriffs who do this all the time are the ones, and they were very helpful in working through and finding where they had real problems that they wanted to address. So a lot of the bill is basically conforming the statute to what the practice had been for many, many years. And the sheriffs actually have a manual that's about this thick. I have a copy at my office on how to do these things. And even that manual did not address all the different fact situations that they were faced with. So with that, and since my voice is starting to go, I think I'll shut up and let Jerry talk a little bit.
I don't know how much it's worth reiterating what we talked about last time. Let me say just a few things. This was a pretty large work group. It was broadly representative. There were representatives who attended regularly from the debtor-creditor section of the bar, from the Department of Justice, from the courts, Office of State Court Administrator, title company representative, and from the sheriff's department, two deputy sheriffs from two different counties who brought their expertise to bear. Dave said hundreds of hours. He's right. He probably put in the majority of those since he was the person that did the drafting, actual drafting work based upon each iteration of this product. The amendments are, as you see them, they are for the most part technical. They were responsive to the fact that we moved this bill along as rapidly as we could to get something to you, and I think they do a good job of taking care of the remaining details. There are, for example, three or four pages in those amendments that really do nothing other than add some definitions and then take and delete three or four pages from the bill, the original bill, and change the corresponding sections to utilize those definitions so that the terminology is better and clearer than it was to start with. It has been either directly gone over in great depth by the members of this work group, or they have seen all of the parts of it, including all of these amendments, and responded to them over email. I think it's fair to say this is really a consensus bill, that it is regarded by the people who worked on it as, whether perfect or not, a significant advance over existing law in this area, and we'll bring it to you for your consideration. I'd be happy to try to respond to any questions.
I'd be happy to ask them if I could think of any. The question I can think of is, was there any dissent? You said it was a consensus bill. Were there any people in the work group who did not like it for one reason or another?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I think that you can always tweak wording and tweak paragraphs, and we had plenty of that kind of discussion. I don't believe, I wouldn't want to speak for any individuals, I don't believe anybody on the committee felt that this was not a good bill to advance.
Okay. And just for the committee, because some of you were gone, this came at the end of the day on the 13th of April, and we did have people from the Sheriff's Association, the courts, and some individual sheriffs testify for this, and there was no opposition at that hearing, and none has surfaced.
That's correct. And those who did testify, as the record will show, testified in support of it and in support of the -2 amendments.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is there any discussion, Senator Beyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of basic questions. First, what happens to people out in the real world, not lawyers, not judges, not sheriffs, if this bill passes? What changes?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, for one thing, I think the average person would have a better chance of knowing what the law is based on reading what's in this bill than they would with trying to understand the old statutes. The old statutes were almost incomprehensible even to a lawyer, even to practitioners who have been working on it for a long time. This one here actually kind of starts at the beginning and goes to the end about what happens in these proceedings. And it does retain all of those provisions of law that were previously in there to try to give warning to people about loss of their house and other things that had come in over the years to try to prevent abuses. So I'm not sure that there's going to be a radical difference in the substantive effect on any person as far as what happens to them. There were some additional notice provisions, I think, that probably worked their way in to make sure everybody knew what was happening as this went through.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Senator. That was the question I was trying to formulate myself, so I appreciate you, you coming up with it. Are there any other committee members bold enough to ask a question here?
Senator Burdick, Senator Beyer, I should mention, too, there are some substantive changes in here that will have real-world effect. I'm not sure any of them are, though, of the type that harm debtors. Randy Jordan's here. I think he's probably got a better feel from the Department of Justice. He has some a better feel on that. But just briefly, it does allow, for instance, redemption rights on mobile homes, which did not exist before. If you had a manufactured dwelling that was sitting on a piece of property, it was sold separately from the property, and the result of that was actually that you didn't have the right to come back and pay the money and get it back later. The bill, in order to try to get some more consistency in the way real property is handled, says, look, you can sell manufactured dwelling as part of the real property, in which event there will be redemption rights. So to some degrees, there are some very good things in here for debtors as well. Thank you.
Mr. Swank, did you want to add something? to this. I don't think you had a chance to talk last time, so please welcome the committee. This has been done in a little bit disjointed way. My apologies.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Brad Swank, Special Counsel for Government Relations for the Oregon Judicial Department. I just, for the sake of the members when they're carrying this on the floor, I thought I would point out a couple of provisions. There are some substantive changes, and there are some things that somebody might notice and you might want to have a response to if they notice it. And there are two particular provisions I wanted to point out in this respect.
Senator Ringo will appreciate that.
One of them is Section 24, and one of them is Section 37. And let me explain that the bill primarily restructures and draws a roadmap for judicial sales. And I know some of you will be disappointed that that doesn't mean selling judges. It means selling things under judicial authority. And one of the things that came up, for a long time, judicial sales have been conducted primarily as auctions, where there's a sheriff's auction and they bring something in and they post notice and they send notice to people and people get to come bid on the property. And one of the questions that came up in the work group is, what about eBay? You know, the market is changing. The way things are being sold are changing, and now we're going more electronically. Should we try to address the potential of an electronic market and what can happen in the future? Because when you go to an electronic market, you not only have the potential for people in the county who get the notice in the local newspaper that there's a judicial sale, you've got the potential for people worldwide. You can actually get substantially higher prices, and you may have to sell less of somebody's property to get the money to pay off the judgment. So two of the provisions that were put in the bill that are the work group decided that they were struggling enough with the notices on the normal auction procedure, but two of the provisions that were put in, one was Section 24, and it's something that the courts volunteered to the project, was that to the extent that we have money, maybe not after this session, but someday when we have money, we would volunteer to set up maybe a website where people could post notices of these sales, so that would be an official notice that could be published, so people not just in Oregon but all over could find out that things were being sold for money at a judicial sale and could bid on. The other thing was that's in Section 24. In Section 37, it says that an individual judge for a specific case can order a sale subject to different provisions than are set out in this statutory series. And the Chief Justice, by rule, can set up different provisions for judicial sales if the Chief Justice, somebody brings something to the Chief Justice and it makes sense to do in rule. And part of this was to allow the Chief Justice, a court in an individual circumstances where it may have made more sense to sell it on eBay or by a mail sale or some other way, where the parties said, why don't we try a different way to sell this to generate more money, or the Chief Justice, if some kind of new procedure came up that worked, like eBay, and one of the members of the committee joked and said we could call it Court Bay. But anyway, that allows the Chief Justice to set those up by rules. I thought I would point those out to you just in case somebody on the floor raised the question as to why those were there, and I thought you'd want to know about it.
I appreciate that very much. So those two substantive changes, and then the changes about mobile homes was another one, and then...
There's even more than that, Senator Burdick, when you start going through it, but they were all consensus changes. I'm not aware of anything that there's a dissenting vote on from the work group that I heard from the work group as I was going through.
And you had representatives from all parts of the spectrum, everyone on all sides who's involved in these kind of issues. Is that correct?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Yes, I believe that's correct. I mean, you're talking about broad segments of the interested public, and it was broadly representative in that fashion. If I could just kind of broadly characterize what they were trying to do, other than just clean up things, would be to provide better notice to people throughout. There's a lot of attention given to notices, to clarifying who gets notice and how it's given, and under the different parts of the process as you go from levying on property to start with down through the redemption process. Two, taking steps, the electronic sections being an example, that hopefully by making things clear, making things easier, allowing for more bids, will enhance the prices that debtors receive through the sale, thereby in some cases making it less necessary to sell some property. And in all of that, seeming to have a desire to be, you know, fair and equitable to the different rights that people in this very complex and also very uncomfortable and very unfortunate process would have.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? Appreciate you all being here today. Okay, we will. We're in work session. We have the dash two amendments.
Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 920.
Senator Starr has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 920. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Senate Bill 920 is amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 920 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Spingle, I really meant it.
I'm
I would
happy
like it. Okay. We will open. We have Senate Bill 1025 on the agenda today, and that has experienced some issues that will require it to be transferred to next Monday's agenda, where it will be heard with a related bill, Senate Bill 99. And our last item of business in what will be the last short day of this session for Judiciary Committee members, I hope you appreciate it, will be to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 495. And Senator Ringo, this is yours.
Sure. Madam Chair, colleagues, I prepared this bill, and currently under Oregon law, wrongful death lawsuits are creatures of statute. And the law sets forth who can collect on a wrongful death action for types of damages. And grandchildren and grandparents are not able to recover for their loss of society and companionship, which is their non-economic damages, for the death of a grandparent or grandchild. Currently, the parents are you can get compensation for brothers, sisters, but not grandparents or grandchildren. And it seems to me that there are lots of families out there where children live with grandparents, and that the loss of one of those, whether it's the grandchild or the grandparent, is a very substantial loss, and there ought to be some method of recovering compensation for that loss.
Thank you. And Senator Ringo, you had told me earlier that there are some people that you know that would like to testify on this, and I wanted to get the hearing, the legal requirement of the hearing done today,
okay.
And we will make accommodations for anyone you want to bring when we move this to work session.
Okay.
Are there any questions for Senator Ringo, who is our sole witness on this?
Questions.
Senator Pozanski.
Thank you, Madam.
Senator Pozanski is looking at the back of the page on the punitive judgment. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm looking at both sides, actually.
Yeah.
So is there any parameters as to what the nexus of the grandchildren are to the grandparent and the grandparent to the grandchildren?
The short answer is no. I think it would be similar to the nexus for other relatives where, let's say a child has not lived with a parent for many, many years. You know, I've seen cases where somebody said, no, I haven't seen my mom for 20 years, but you know, there's a subject for wrongful death action, and the reality is, what are the damages? Because there was no close connection. So even though legally there might be damages, practically speaking, there would be very little. And I think the same analysis would apply for grandchildren and grandparents.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 495 and close our record-breakingly short Judiciary Committee meeting, and this is the last one that's going to be short. We just had some things that had to be moved off the agenda. So Senate Judiciary is adjourned.
I set the entire hearing. I set the entire hearing.